This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hear about a note of hope for those wanting to preserve the State Farm building in downtown Bloomington.
We're seeing just in so many places around the country people being successful in finding creative ways to adapt older buildings to new needs.
Jim Lindbergh of the National Trust for Historic Preservation offers inspiration from across the country. Plus, if current trends continue, it will take more than 2 centuries for women in the U.S. to gain pay equity with men. Some women tell Mary Cullen, that ain't right. And how to train a feral dog as a Ugandan herd guard. Brianna Groh tells us more. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. State Farm's recent decision to demolish its former downtown Bloomington headquarters has left local officials scrambling to prevent an iconic community structure from disappearing. Community leaders seek inspiration and one or more buyers, though they don't know how much time they have to search. Communities with similar challenges have sometimes found ways to save historic buildings. WGLT's Eric Stock reports experts say the undertaking requires cooperation, vision, and usually government help.
State Farm used its downtown building for 9 decades. Architect Russell Francois knows what the 13-story landmark represents to the community. He's worked under its long shadow a block away for more than 4 decades.
As a downtown business owner and building owner, and with so much involvement in the downtown community, I felt it was probably the single biggest loss that would result from a demolition of the building.
Francois calls the old headquarters the community's most identifiable building. It was once the tallest high-rise between St. Louis and Chicago. The giant block letter State Farm sign glowed red over the downtown until last year after the insurance giant closed the office and tried to sell it. The company had gradually taken staff out of the 200,000-square-foot Art Deco building as the company sought what it calls more collaborative physical workspaces. 5 months ago, a real estate broker representing an unnamed developer said it would save the building with a mix of retail, restaurants, and offices. That deal fell through. State Farm announced last month it will demolish the building.
It made as much logic to me as I'm trying to sell my house, and the first buyer comes along, says, I don't want your house. I'm going to say, well, geez, nobody wants my house. I'm going to tear it down.
Historian Greg Coos helped organize a group of 17 downtown stakeholders called the Save Our State Farm Building. The group is asking the company to give it more time to help come up with another solution. They fear imminent demolition will scare off potential investors. The group has also launched an online petition to save the building. The McLean County Assessor's Office lists the building's market value at just under $9 million. Who suggests State Farm is moving quickly to spare the cost of maintaining the building while it sits empty. He asks, what's the rush?
State Farm is, what, a $100 billion corporation? The idea that State Farm somehow can't afford to maintain that building is just laughable.
Historic preservationists such as Jim Lindbergh offer stories of inspiration from all across the country. Lindbergh is the senior policy director for the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
We're seeing just in so many places around the country and people being successful in finding creative ways to adapt older buildings to new needs.
Lindbergh says many companies in smaller Midwestern cities have saved large historic structures from demolition. For example, the first skyscraper ever built in Iowa. At 19 stories, Equitable of Iowa in Des Moines was the Hawkeye State's tallest building for 50 years. It housed an insurance company. After nearly two decades of fits and starts, in 2016, buyers converted the building into two stories of commercial space, more than 140 apartments, and a penthouse condo with a rooftop patio. Closer to home is the Mississippi River city of Dubuque, Iowa. It's about the size of Normal. Dubuque has reinvented itself as a city with more than 1,300 historic properties. It claims several redevelopment successes. The crown jewel is a 186,000-square-foot window and door factory that is now an innovation center, blending retail shops, nonprofits, and artists with loft apartments. The price tag was close to $34 million. Landmarks Illinois calls itself the state's leading voice for historic preservation. The nonprofit counts the McLean County Museum of History among its reclamation success stories. Frank Butterfield is director of Landmark Illinois' Springfield office and a member of the Save Our State Farm Building Committee.
They should be very hesitant about allowing a demolition of this scale. We've seen revitalization success stories, and they almost always involved finding a preservation solution for a building that this is this prominent.
One of downtown Peoria's most prominent buildings is the century-old former Chase Bank. Caterpillar abandoned it 2 years ago after the heavy equipment company announced plans to move its corporate headquarters to Chicago. In stepped OSF Healthcare, which bought the building and the entire block for a dollar and is moving its headquarters and 700-plus employees there.
And in addition, Caterpillar donated what they would have spent on demolition towards the rehab effort. So now we have roughly an $80 million project where OSF Healthcare is going to put its employees downtown.
Caterpillar donated $3 million to the project. Each of these adaptive use projects has an element in common: government assistance in the form of state and national tax credits. In the Des Moines Insurance Building renovation, the developer spent $38 million and got $6.2 million in federal and $6.4 million in state tax credits. The OSF project could get as much as $10 million each in state and federal incentives. In every project, developers say assistance is critical. Redevelopment projects can tap into tax credits through a federal program that began in 1977. It encourages rehab of buildings listed on the National Register of Historic Places by offering an 80-20 local match of rehab expenses. State Farm took advantage of this program in 2004 to renovate the former headquarters. State Farm secured $2.5 million in federal tax credits back then. Jim Lindberg with the National Trust for Historic Preservation says there's a growing demand for renovated spaces. He says applications for the federal tax credit program jumped 9% in the last year.
For many years, I think this was maybe an unusual thing. And I think more and more in every kind of community, large and small, we see this happening and people are seeing it work. I don't think anybody's looking at these projects and saying, oh, that was a mistake. They're saying, wow, that was a great idea. Let's do more of that.
Lindberg warns the National Register designation may unlock incentives to reinvent a property, but won't stop an owner from tearing it down. Illinois is one of 36 states with their own historic tax credits, though the program began only last year. The state tax credits cover 25% of renovation costs, up to $3 million. Illinois caps the program at $15 million per year. Lindberg says developers compete for the money.
You know, the experience we see around the country shows that states that have these state credits that can be combined with the federal, that's just a powerful incentive that can really accelerate the investment in older buildings and revitalization in communities.
These massive multi-million dollar projects are not easy to do. You need a buyer and investors willing to assume financial risk. A history professor at Illinois State University says you also need a community vision of how to attract traffic toward its most historical elements. Alan Lessoff says Bloomington has lacked vision in decades of failed planning. Lessoff is working on a McLean County Museum of History exhibit and book chronicling Bloomington Normal's planning missteps and missed opportunities. He's also a member of the Save Our State Farm Building Committee. Lessoff says downtown Bloomington is paying the price for a half century of bad planning, including engineering one-way traffic through and around downtown. He says that created a moat that isolated the central business district. Lessoff says the city also made space for parking lots and garages, which made it easier for people to drive away from the city's core. Commercial and retail business, he says, migrated to Veterans Parkway and other points east. Lessoff says city planners have spent several decades now trying to correct errors by bringing more multi-purpose, mixed-use buildings to the city center for people to shop, park, and live. But he says the city remains slow to act on recommendations, even ones the city paid for. Lessoff says letting State Farm tear down its historic building would be another mistake that would take decades to overcome.
I think if you let the State Farm building go, the result would be something, anything that went in there would be pretty dreary by comparison to what can be put in that building.
State Farm's and Bloomington's growth were heavily intertwined in times past. Lessoff says it was hard to imagine the company ever diminishing its role in the community.
A lot of the political discussion in this town, and I'm moralizing a little, take State Farm for granted, that they'll be the presence that will back us up.
Lessoff says that dynamic created a paternalistic relationship that caught Bloomington flat-footed when State Farm pulled out of downtown.
And people just expect it to do things for the city. And when the company finds, well, it's got to do other things, people get angry at it and blame it and say, well, you're not doing things for us.
Lessoff thinks even today, many aren't grasping the magnitude of losing one of downtown's most significant structures.
I really think that people aren't imagining this problem in the magnitude that's facing us. I still think that they're taking for granted that things are going to be okay here. And even though changes are happening all around them.
Lessoff suggests the city could use historic preservation rules to slow the start of demolition, but the city can't stop it. He suggests the city buy the building only as a last resort. He says the city already has vacant lots, such as the former Electrolux and Brokaw Hospital site north of downtown. Lessoff suspects one reason the city of Bloomington is hesitant to intervene is a case of once bitten, twice shy.
A lot of cities have had that, and it does become a problem of argument. Well, you promised us this about that. How do we know that your promises about this, right, are going to come true? It's a real political problem.
The downtown arena is an example that could be fueling the city's resistance. The structure has never fulfilled its promise. Former city council member Karen Schmidt voted against the arena, but is also serving on the Save Our State Farm Building Committee. She sees opportunity, but senses the skepticism.
I've heard overwhelming support for this, though I think there's a lot of caution that the city not take on more real estate and more of financial burdens.
Even Mayor Terry Renner acknowledges the city has suffered from paralysis by analysis, especially when compared to its Twin Cities neighbor.
Town of Normal is like white on rice. City of Bloomington has been much less activist. And we're changing. We're getting better. But it is definitely not been our culture to seize and grab opportunities to expand our local economy and expand economic development, especially in our downtown.
Renner also sits on the committee with Normal Mayor Chris Skous. Renner tries to assure the public the city won't get into a boondoggle just to save face.
We are not going to get into reckless or irresponsible types of deals. We've shown that with the hotel in downtown Bloomington. I mean, nobody wanted a hotel, a conference center that was closer to, you know, close to the Coliseum more than I did. But we did not take any deal that was coming along.
A number of Bloomington residents say redevelopment should be left to the private sector. That was one of the sentiments expressed to Councilmember Jen Carrillo in community listening sessions. Carrillo says part of the public also says the city should do anything it can to keep the building intact. She says the public hasn't given her clear marching orders.
That was a thing that I kind of already felt in my gut. And I think that these listening sessions have confirmed that people have strong feelings, but also on the plus side, people can see each other. Argument for or against city intervention to save the building.
Advocates say the possibilities for repurposing the State Farm building are endless. The cost of renovation will depend on the plan. Mayor Terry Renner says that gets tricky for committee members who want to help find a buyer because they don't have access to the building, so they're going off of past experience of word of mouth when trying to explain the condition of the structure.
We need to know more, and State Farm knows we need to know more, and we've asked to have more information. And so we're hoping to get in fairly short order and with perhaps some possible investors, so maybe we can do some one-stop shopping.
Architect Russell Francois says the committee wants to know specifics on the condition of the building, including environmental concerns and what he calls a shopping cart to present to prospective developers.
I think those would be sort of the minimum that I see. And then also, what do they expect out of the building? And what could a developer do to have them feel whole at the end of this process?
Without knowing specifics, committee members have said the building is in excellent shape. Remember that $12 million renovation 15 years ago. Francois says having a working elevator and sprinkler systems are big pluses. Committee member Greg Koo says the building's open floor plan allows access to natural lighting, which would make for an easy transition for a technology company to fill.
The workers of the new information economy really value natural daylight. They value being close to a window. They value having fresh air in their workspace. So this kind of building is actually an attraction.
Francois says the State Farm building, with all its history, is exactly the kind of structure that attracts millennials who would work or shop in the new building. He says in his travels downtown, he often sees them getting photographed for graduations and weddings in places like alleys, old doorways, and other decrepit-looking spaces.
I believe there's a search for authenticity, and we're seeing nationally so many developments that cue back into Art Deco or pretend to be historic buildings, and they're simply not.
There's another reason historian Greg Koo says the State Farm building should not be torn down. He says the environmental impact from a prolonged demolition would dramatically increase the size of the community's carbon footprint.
Preserving buildings has an immediate impact on the carbon footprint that any particular community expresses. Building new is far more wasteful, if you will, particularly when you have a lot of unclaimed empty properties.
Committee members aren't saying if they believe their efforts will save the State Farm building from demolition, but Francois says he's simply asking the company exhaust all options first.
Let's all work together and see if together our efforts will yield the result that we're all looking for, and that is a continued good neighbor approach in the Bloomington Normal area.
Committee members say they want State Farm to appoint a company representative to meet with the group to help understand reasons for the planned demolition and the teardown timeline. I'm Eric Stock.
State Farm officials declined to be interviewed for this story. The company essentially reissued their earlier statement that it remains open to conversation with the city but is moving forward with plans to demolish the building.
Then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned how to get along. And so you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just 1 second you'd be back to bother me. Oh, now go, walk out the door.
This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Westminster Village, a locally owned and operated not-for-profit providing quality retirement living, offering independent living, licensed assistant living, and skilled nursing care on a beautiful campus of more than 40 acres. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a story of flooding and fixing flood damage. Women in leadership across Bloomington Normal agree the time is long past for equal pay in the workplace, but they say salary is only part of the battle for workplace gender equality. WGLT's Mary Cullen has the story.
The Pew Research Center estimates the average woman in 2018 made 85 cents for every dollar white males with the same responsibilities and qualifications made. That includes female-dominated fields like teaching and nursing. The gap is even larger for women of color, who must work an average of 20 months to equal the pay her white male counterpart makes in 1 year. On average, the pay equals out around August 22nd. To acknowledge the date, Illinois State University's College of Arts and Sciences, the YWCA, and the League of Women Voters of McLean County hosted an equal pay discussion. Panelists addressed a majority female crowd about battling workplace stereotypes with the goal of closing the gender wage gap. Pam Cooper is the director of ISU's Career Center. She says she made $1.12 an hour scooping ice cream in her first job.
I bet the young men who were working next to me, and I didn't know to ask the question, how much did they make, but I bet they made more. But I didn't know. I didn't know to ask. I didn't know to negotiate. I didn't know those things. And I think that young people today will know those things. And so it'll get better.
The nation has made some progress narrowing the wage gap since Cooper entered the workforce, but it's minimal. The World Economic Forum estimates at present rates of change, U.S. pay rates will not reach gender equality for another 208 years. For many women, that's not good enough. ISU history professor Kyle Ciani says the 21st century brought great change for women. It was the first time the average woman had access to a female in leadership.
The women of the 19th century didn't have that. The women in the 20th century didn't have that. They had very few CEOs in the 20th century. But living today, we have a lot of role models. We have a lot of mentors. We have a lot of people who we can be in conversation with.
Ciani stresses every woman should have a role model in the workplace. Bloomington City Councilmember Jen Carrillo says having a female mentor gives women an outlet to practice conversations about equal pay and treatment in the workplace. Carrillo says Ciani has been her longtime mentor, and Carrillo says Ciani taught her a lot about cultivating self-worth, especially in salary negotiation. She says she used to think,
what if I ask for too much and they don't want me to work there anymore? And it's like, well, first of all, that's probably not a place I want to work, right? Second of all, like, how many injustices are done to women in the name of this, what if I'm asking for too much, right? We are never asking for too much.
Carrillo says self-worth is something women have to encourage each other to build. But women also have to be the ones to claim their own power.
Through the entire time that I was running for office, it's just like, am I qualified for this? Am I smart enough for this? Am I, you know, all those things, those are messages that, you know, I've been carrying around with me my whole life. And there shouldn't be an expectation that those things are going to just disappear from you in a moment. But it is certainly one of those things where, like, practice makes perfect.
She says part of that is becoming aware of stereotypes that come with being a woman at work.
Because you're being judged by them. But I do think that you've got some important choices and you have to be willing to make them tactically.
And sometimes, Carrillo says you have to be willing to become a stereotype.
Yeah, people are going to pass those kinds of judgments. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're in a bad place. Like, you can live into the, like, angry Mexican lady stereotype, and you can just lean right into that. Because in trying to avoid it, you sort of corner yourself into, like, well, now I can never express a negative emotion.
She says by trying to avoid critiques, women can put themselves in a box. And as Carrillo says, that can be exhausting. Human resources professional Ann Perry says picking up on those typical working woman behaviors is something that's learned over a lifetime.
There have been many times when I've been in meetings with my peers, all same job titles, and there'll be a question, who's going to take notes?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So there are certain things in meetings that, as females, that you just don't do, because that helps the perception or the labeling of what you're capable of doing.
Do not write it down.
At that point.
Don't write it down.
For women of color, stereotypes can be more severe. According to the American Association of University Women, compared to the white male's dollar in earnings, black women make 61 cents. American Indian and Alaskan Native women make 58 cents, and Latinx women are paid just 53 cents. Historian Kyle Ciani says race needs to be discussed openly and freely in every workspace.
We're not doing so well as a nation right now talking about race. We're trying to shut people up if they don't feel the way that we think about certain things. So I think the workplace can be a safe space.
To address the racial gender pay gap, Ciani says those conversations must begin. And in some respects, she says they are. Ann Perry is not so sure.
I would say we should be able to talk about race in the workplace. But instead, what happens is you have conversations around diversity. So we have, it is not the same.
Perry says to understand how peers think and interact, women have to know them as a person. She says people of all genders and races have to have a seat at the table for the conversation about race. City Councilmember Carrillo says workplace conversations about equality are imperative if we want to see change.
If you are not in an environment or in a headspace where you are fostering your own sense of worthiness, then you're going to have a much more difficult time entering into these kind of conversations. Now, of course, like, you're not socialized to do any of those things. In fact, you're socialized to feel quite the opposite.
And Carrillo says battling those ingrained behaviors takes practice.
I think that a cultivation of that worthiness as a daily practice is super, super important, and ultimately, like, makes you that much more powerful and dangerous in terms of, like, when you start advocating for yourself and negotiating.
Carrillo says women in work groups everywhere are finding ways to acknowledge, praise, and elevate the work and ideas of their female peers. She recommends a practice used by female staffers at the start of the Obama administration called echoing.
If they were around a table at a meeting and, like, a woman would share an idea and it would get passed over in the meeting, then another woman would say, oh, I think Anne just said this, and would echo it, right, until it was heard by the people in the room.
She says practicing sisterhood and community can help women in all workplaces, and specifically those in male-dominated offices. By changing the way women approach their roles in the workplace, Kyle Ciani, Jen Carrillo, Ann Perry, and Pam Cooper say they hope younger women can see gender equality achieved in their lifetimes, because no woman has 208 years to wait. I'm Mary Cullen.
The American Association of University Women estimates the average Illinois gender pay ratio at 78% of what men make.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, how to convert a feral predator into a herd dog. Brianna Groh has that story. As cities and counties figure out how much money they spent fighting this year's record-setting flood on the Mississippi River, the Corps of Engineers and two other groups are working on long-term solutions. Michelle O'Neill reports river communities in five states are taking a different approach to managing the river and preventing flood damage.
Shared responsibility and coordinated strategy are phrases that come up repeatedly in the report released after the 1993 flood. After the Mississippi River broke several records again this year, those exact same themes are coming up again. Colin Wellenkamp is the executive director of the Mississippi River Cities and Towns Initiative. He says management of the upper half of the river is not unified, calling it a mishmash of flood protection measures. That's in stark contrast to the lower Mississippi River system, which is largely owned and operated by the Corps of Engineers.
Missouri itself has no levee statute at all. So anybody can go and put up a levee in Missouri for at any height, as close to the water as they want to, and they do. You won't get your permit from FEMA or the Corps because you haven't met their guidelines, but it's okay. You could still do it. You haven't broken any state laws, and that creates significant dangers and problems for our mayors because they have to contend with the impacts and fallout of that activity.
Mayors from Mississippi River cities and towns are promoting management practices on a much broader scale, and Wellenkamp says the Corps of Engineers has already identified places along the upper stretch of the river to protect critical infrastructure and add wetlands to prevent flooding.
Our mayors have shown, even in the face of this, remaining committed to not putting up new levees and flood walls because they know that's just going to make the problem worse. It's just going to, and it, not only for themselves, but for their neighbors. So you're not only endangering your neighbor, but you're endangering yourself because you create a more dangerous situation systemically for the corridor by putting up more levees, more flood wall, more constrictions to the river. So we are committed to not doing that, equally committed to instead pursuing these natural infrastructure solutions as well as managing the system as a whole system.
Meantime, more than a year ago, the Corps of Engineers in Rock Island began working with the Upper Mississippi River Basin Association on a 2-year initiative to take a broad approach to flooding, dredging, and drought. Project engineer Steve Price says first people need to understand the Mississippi and its watershed are unique.
By the nature of the navigation industry being so closely tied to the Mississippi and all the communities up and down, and you know, there's a lot of populous cities, obviously, up and down the Miss, not to say that there's not a lot of cities and communities on other bodies of water, but I just think it's a little more complex when you have so many stakeholders and the economy is so closely tied to the upper Miss.
The Basin Association represents 5 states located on the Mississippi: Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, and Wisconsin. And Price calls the joint project with the Corps of Engineers the 729.
I think it's important to note under like the 729 watershed study, it would include authorities outside of just the federal government. So we would look at ways to integrate the state and local governments, communities, and stakeholders within the study and not just look at federal projects, because if we're looking at federal projects, we're fairly limited on solutions. And so under a watershed study, we would look at solutions that could be implemented by other levels of government. And I think that's the importance that the 729 brings.
Price also says coming to consensus won't be easy.
When you talk about a watershed solution to some of the problems, there's going to be different opinions, I think, on the right solution. So I think it's going to be important for, you know, to have those discussions and figure out where the sideboards are, where there's leeway, you know, what's acceptable, and having that dialogue with the states and the communities so that you could document it, figure out what the challenges are, and come up with an agreeable solution to all, because, you know, one size may not fit all for all the communities. And so I think being dynamic and flexible throughout the studies is something that will lead to ultimate success.
I'm Michelle O'Neill.
The Corps of Engineers and Upper Mississippi River Basin Association will accept written comments until after a final public meeting later this fall. They want local residents to tell them about the problems they face and ideas to solve them. The goal is to incorporate local needs and solutions into a plan for managing the entire watershed of the Upper Mississippi River. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A program to train feral dogs to guard farmers and their fields from theft has seen success in Uganda this summer. GLT News correspondent Brianna Groh talks with a local dog trainer, Tina Zimmerman, founder of Mainstream Harvest Guards International, about the difference the program has made in the lives of both farmers and their dogs.
I have been traveling to different parts of Africa since 2010 and actually became friends with a missionary family there who teaches a farming program. And in the last 5 years, they've started to teach vanilla farming. And so vanilla farming is very lucrative, and it grows really good in that part of the country, the southwest part of Uganda. And so the farmers there are actually starting to turn a good profit, finally getting a little bit out of the poverty there. But what started to happen then is that people saw the opportunity of stealing from them. And so they were going into their fields in the evening after dark, stealing the vanilla and selling it. And so the farmers were losing a lot of profit. So what they started to do was to actually sleep out in their fields. And a lot of the farmers are women. Their mothers or fathers who were having to, number one, leave their families alone in their homes. And the homes there, most of them don't have a door like what we think of. It's a curtain or a blanket of some sort. So they can't lock their family up. Nobody's there to protect them. Not only that, the farmers are exposed to malaria. They're being victims now of crime and of violence because they're out in the middle of the night sleeping alone in their fields. And so the missionary who is there had seen some of the training programs that I do here in the States and just said, hey, do you think there's any way you could come here and train dogs to protect the farmers? And so we said, well, let's try it. And so Harvest Guards was kind of birthed out of that. We did one session, a month-long session back in November and December. It worked incredibly well. I went back and started another school in another part of Uganda, a bigger school. It went really well. And since then, they've now, just in the last couple months, had their first vanilla harvest since they've had their guard dogs protecting their farms. And their production was huge because they got to keep it all for themselves. So we're starting to already see some success with the program.
So this was truly built out of you went to a place in need, and you had a certain set of skills that could fill that need. You have a business, Mainstream Training.
Yeah.
How long have you run that, and how did you get into that?
I started training animals as a teenager, dogs, horses. We lived on a farm, and I just had a gift for it. I had a passion for it. Was very heavily into training horses and competing, and then had a really bad accident and kind of backed off of that and started leaning more heavily towards dogs. Did it kind of on the side. I was a vet tech for years, and so got a lot of clients through that, but it was just kind of a side thing. But in 2007, I opened Mainstream Training as full-time facility.
Okay. So Harvest Guards International, you mentioned that some of the success with this is helping lift some of the residents out of poverty. What poverty are they experiencing?
Well, it's definitely a third world country. There is no insurance. They are completely dependent on the process working correctly. So if it doesn't rain, the process gets messed up. Now they have to carry water, which they will carry, you know, 20 gallons on their head barefooted on a rocky hill. People without clothes, people who die of very treatable diseases like diarrhea. They're very, very dependent on each other and on things going well. And so it's so sad that when they get a skill like farming and then the crop grows well because it's a good area for it and they have good rain and they see the vanilla coming on. And to wake up in the morning and it be gone, it's just gut-wrenching. You don't just start over the next day. You know, it's 3 years before you have vanilla again on a vine.
And here in the States, if that were to happen to a crop, you know, a farmer might get the police involved. Is that just not even an option in these villages?
It's law there is very subjective. There's not a police department. Those who can afford security could hire a guard to walk the fields in the evening. They don't have a lot of access to weapons to protect themselves, and so what they would have would be a machete or a big stick. It would very much be hand-to-hand combat. I mean, it's just primitive. And so, yeah, they can't dial 911, you know, and have the police chase down the thief. They wake up and it's gone.
So what makes dogs a good solution for this problem?
Well, dogs, as we know here, are so trainable to track, you know, to apprehend someone, to just guard. But what we started with in Uganda was a culture of seeing dogs as a nuisance animal. They understand that dogs kill their livestock. Dogs bite people. Dogs carry rabies. That's how they view a dog. And so for me to introduce the concept of domesticating a dog and teaching it to do this was completely mind-blowing to them. There was no concept. But they trusted the process. They trusted me. They just are willing to try anything. So that's where we started.
Let's talk a little bit about the training process. So who exactly are you training? Is it farmers, or are you really getting more of the broader community involved?
Right now, we've restricted the program to only these vanilla farmers who have been in the farming program. The farming program that's there is Harvest Hands International. That's kind of where we got our name off of them, because we're partnering with them.
The dogs that are working in this program, where are they coming from? I understand that actually some of them are feral. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
When we set up the program, when I first talked to my friend who has been there for 22 years, he assured me that because they are doing well with their farming, they could afford to buy a German Shepherd type dog, and that up in Kampala, which is a good 7 hours drive from where we're working, there are breeders there. So we said, let's go with German Shepherd puppies between the age of 6 months to a year and a half. Mm-hmm. You know, we want larger dogs that are going to finish out at about 80 pounds. And so we gave them, you know, from March to November to buy dogs and get them. That's so not what happened. Mm-hmm. So when I arrived the first day, I said, don't bring your dogs. We need to just have orientation and talk. And then I asked, you know, how much does your dog weigh? And one man said 5 kilograms. And I'm doing math in my head, 2.2 kilograms per, that's like a 12-pound dog, you know. And it was pretty common, 20 kilograms, 30 kilograms. Okay. So then the first day of school, they come with their dogs, and they were just feral dogs that they had. They would watch for a dog to have puppies, and while the puppy was young enough to snatch away, they would get that puppy.
This is Sound Ideas, and I'm Brianna Groh. I'm talking with Tina Zimmerman, who is part of Mainstream Harvest Guards International. That's a program that she founded that empowers people in Uganda to train dogs to protect their farms and families. So now you're faced with a situation where you have a training program, but dogs who are not domesticated.
Right.
Are they still trainable?
I wanted German Shepherds because they're normal guard dogs. They love to chase and bite. They love to guard. What showed up was feral dogs who were terrified of the people. The people were terrified of the dogs, and they brought them in on chains. The first day was just me trying to get the chains off the dog and a collar on the dog, as well as treat them with a flea and tick prevention and some worm medication. And so that was the whole first day. Just the fear in the dog's eyes and the shock of the people of me taking these dogs and just handling them like I'm used to do, you know, working at the vet. Mm-hmm. So the first challenge was, you know, here in America, you present a dog with a piece of food, and then you get them to cooperate and do what you want, and you reward them with the food. Mm-hmm. But day two was, number one, the dogs didn't recognize the food that I had brought. I brought 2 bags of dog food, you know. They didn't recognize that as food.
Right.
And so that didn't motivate them whatsoever. Number two, when I would reach my hand out to them, they shrieked down, you know, instead of being rewarded. And so We just went back to basics of, let's just be in a place of peace with our dogs, sit down on the ground, pull the dog to you, and put your hand on him. And that was day two, put your hand on your dog. And the fear in both the handler and the dog was like nothing I've ever seen before. Day three, the magic started to happen. The people were learning to touch the dogs, and the dogs were melting, just sinking down to the ground and flopping over, belly up. And all of a sudden, the humans were realizing that there's something different about a dog than the cattle that they drive or the goats that they drive, that this dog has a connection with them. Then we were able to really start the training process.
And so once that training can begin, what are the objectives for you?
Well, first and foremost, and this was a huge concern, I had several of the village chiefs come and talk to me that they were concerned about the safety of the people. If we're training these dogs to attack, how is that working? How is that going to be safe? Mm-hmm. And so the very first phase of the training is the same as I do here: obedience, obedience, obedience. We had some of those rubber wristbands made up. They had to be able to make their dog sit, lie down, stay, and come when called to earn a wristband. And so the next 2 weeks were a lot. But in order to proceed, they had to be able to do those obedience skills, and they had to bring their dog and walk up to another person and shake their hand, and the dog had to sit quietly beside them.
And how long does it take from starting training to having a graduated pair of handler and dog?
There, I was mind blown by how quickly they progressed because they took it so seriously. For one thing, we trained all day. What we'd do is we'd work with the dogs for a little bit, and then we would sit. There was a massive acacia tree that we would sit under. We would take breaks, and we would talk about things about nutrition and veterinary care and things like that. And you have to always be aware that we're never going to make them Americans, and that's not my goal. Our program has to be reproducible. Mm-hmm. My goal is to eventually back out of that part of Uganda. I've already got two trainers there that I'm working with, having them doing some of the training. So eventually it can be a Ugandan program, not an American program. But it was interesting to me, we were talking about nutrition, that dogs need animal protein, which the only thing that they have access to that they can afford is these little white fish called McKenna. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about that, how much they need to feed and that they need to have water. And one of the gentlemen said, we didn't know we're supposed to feed our dogs. We just turn them loose like they do cattle. You drive them down the road and they forage for food. And these dogs are also skinny because they're not feeding them. And on top of that, now I'm telling them, you can't let these dogs run free. You have to keep them confined because you're training them to guard. And so now the dogs, if they do keep them confined, they don't have access to food. And to hear someone say, we didn't know we were supposed to feed our dogs, we didn't know we're supposed to give them water, that tells you how much of a culture shift we're having to make there, but right. They're doing it. And now, at the end of the last period I was there, they threw a little banquet, which was so sweet, where they stood up and gave speeches, and they said before, when they would eat their food, if they saw a dog, they would chase the dog off. Now, before they eat, they make sure their dog is fed.
Wow. I would imagine that a lot of the times that people are worried about theft happening would be at night. Mm-hmm. So the dogs that have been through this program, are how does that work? Are they just out in the fields kind of keeping watch, or?
Yes, they... The only way they have of confining the dogs are to tie them up. And I know here that's almost been, you know, it's not even legal. There, number one, the climate is cool in the evening. But they're tying their dogs out and they're listening for the barking. The way we train the dogs is not just vicious, crazy animals. As I said, this is on command. And so in our practices, we're actually using the dogs on a patrol. So they would be walking with the dog, and if they saw somebody in the field, they could do much like we do here, go or I'm going to send the dog, and they send the dog on command. But at the same time, if it happens to be a friend or a family member, they would tell the dog, sit, stay. So the dog understands his job. But if he's tied up, the alert of barking would tell them, somebody's in my field, I need to go check it out.
So they're a lot like an alarm system.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm curious, again, about the relationship that these farmers develop with the dogs. They no longer see them as wild or angry dogs, but is it becoming more of like the kind of relationship as how we see dogs as our companions there?
Yeah, and they're really surprised to learn that. Like I said, these are people, they're farmers in this area. They do have livestock. They may have one or two goats or some chickens or some cows. And, you know, livestock just don't have that eager to please, bond, hold, pet me. I mean, I used to have a pet cow that loved to be scratched, but, you know, they just don't see the animals as a partner. And I would say that was the magic when I made them hold their dog like a baby on their lap, and they looked at me like I was crazy, and then they did it, and felt that connection when the dog's looking them in the eyes and licking them and, you know, leaning in for more scratching. And, you know, our first few days, like I said, was just building that relationship.
Tina Zimmerman also tells correspondent Brianna Groh, one village has reported a substantially larger vanilla harvest because of the dogs. She's expanding to tracker training to catch thieves and has lined up a third village to take part in the project. Learn more about Mainstream Harvest Guards International by visiting their Facebook page at facebook.com/harvestguards. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, Eric Stock, and Brianna Groh. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.